CliffCentral.com. So, a new biography by Pieter Dirk Uys, both Afrikaans and English. It's called The Echo of a Noise, or Weerklank van a Wanklank. The book was released on the 22nd of October, so it's brand new. It's been out for less than this week. And it was also the title of a successful one-man play at Monte Cassino. The book has been described as Pieter Dirk Uys unpowdered. No props, no false eyelashes, no high heels, no security blankets. I don't know that that's the best description of this man or this memoir, because to my mind, he's always been the bravest guy. And I don't think he's ever hidden behind any of that. He's only used them to amplify it for those of us who needed a bit of parody to understand situations that were sometimes a little more complicated, to make them the kind of thing that we talked about that would bring real change. And what an absolutely astonishing life and journey. Yo, I get nervous, though, when I see people's memoirs coming out, because I wonder whether they're at that stage of their lives where someone has said to them, you have to write about this before you're dead, which I hope is not the case, or whether it's an outpouring of their soul and their spirit and a telling of their story, which we may, all of us, accept the person in question, the autobiographer themselves. We often miss out on a lot of the inside stories, the opinions, the feelings, the details. And sometimes these are the most precious books of all. So it's always a pleasure. And it's no different today to see Pieter Dirk Uys. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. I loved what you said all there. It was very nice.
Was it too long? Could I have cut it in half?
No. A woman said to me the other day, she stopped me and she said, Pieter Dirk Uys, listen, when are you going to stop? I said, darling, I'll stop the day you die.
Yeah, well, that's said, exactly it.
And she ran away.
But what a thing to ask someone.
Yeah, but people say to me, aren't you going to retire? I said, I can't even spell the word. What nonsense. What is retire?
Can I just also say, you've done such a thing for darling. I've got a friend who lives there.
Yeah.
She is the biggest community activist for Darling and for what's the place that she
Ace of Fontaine. Yes.
And she sends me updates on all the stuff that you do there. I mean, you've made that little boring town into a place, of choice.
It always had that flower show for 100 years.
Yes.
You know, but the wheelchair sort of creaked and it took time, you know. But no, it is very, it's lovely. We've now got the Darling Brew. We've got the Voorkamer Festival. We've got this weekend, we've got a Scarecrow Festival. People make scarecrows. So the whole of Darling is full of wonderful scarecrows.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and there's even horse scarecrows and chicken scarecrows.
Look at the character of this place. And I don't believe it would have been what it is if it wasn't for you going there.
Well, the longest street in Darling is called the Evita Bessonet Boulevard.
There we go.
Helen Ziller doesn't have a boulevard.
Listen, first of all, congratulations on this book.
Thank you.
It's moving. You've written it in a way that I haven't seen a book written for a long time. I mean, you're a genius producer. And we're used to seeing you on stage and on film. But actually, this is a masterstroke of literary composition, if you ask me, because the way you've put it together is almost like a play. Am I right?
It's like a conversation. I wanted to be a conversation with the reader.
But it feels like we're being presented to as well some of the time, which I like.
And then, of course, the pictures also give a sense of dimension. And it was a really extraordinary therapy to actually focus on those areas, which I've not bothered about. Because
your own history.
Yeah. And, you know, when I read an autobiography, I start on page 35, because from 1 to 34, it's about I was born and then I had my first erection and all that sort of stuff. No. But and I've written two biographies already, autobiographies. One was Elections and Erections, which is about politics and HIV. Mm-hmm. And then the other one, Between the Devil and the Deep, which was about my theatrical and my plays and all. But I've never focused on the family and me as a little creature there and how the development happened and basically the small signposts that changed my life. I mean, the death of your mother is a huge signpost.
Yes.
It's a billboard. But a small little thing, like somebody just saying, like the one thing she always used to say to us when she drove us to the Eisteddfod, Tessie would play the piano and I would sing. And there were always two Eisteddfods in Cape Town, one English and one Afrikaans, separated by 6 months. You know? And my father always said, "You'll win, you must win, win, win. Yes, yes, yes. Bring the medals. Yeah, yeah, yeah." And then Ma would drive us there, and she'd say to us, "Now, have a wonderful time. Enjoy everything. And remember, if you win, you get an ice cream. If you don't win, you get two ice creams." She didn't say when you lose. She didn't
That's
say
That's important,
lose.
Right?
It was a wonderful philosophy. I've been very happy with two ice creams for most of my life.
Yeah, you but know? you've won in such big ways. I mean,
but winning is also a very dangerous thing, because winning makes you actually stand still and stare at something that doesn't move, because it has moved. That's why you've won. It's moved. You've won the race. I want to keep jogging along, not necessarily being the first at the pole, but just keep going, keep moving, and keep adapting, and which I'm doing now. One has to reinvent one's alphabet in this new minefield of hashtags and hate speech.
So, all right. First of all, honest question, hopefully honest answer. Did you want to do this book, or did the publishers prevail upon you?
No. I wanted to do it. In fact, I was going to do it for my own little publishing company, Missing Ink.
Okay.
But the costs are huge, and it's very, very hard to distribute, because that's the major thing, is distribution.
And the business of publishing isn't really your first and foremost love.
Well, you know, it's again, it's like leaving graffiti on a toilet wall. You want to leave something there for people to read. But anyway, so one thing led to another, and Tafelberg said, when I sent it to somebody there, just to say, you know, what do you think of this as a thought, they said, "We love it." And I've done a version in Afrikaans as well, called Weerklink van Van Klank.
Beautiful.
Lovely clunk, clunk,
beautiful.
Clunk, clunk. And here it is. And I think they've done a fabulous job. The pictures are gorgeous, the way they've set them out.
So many things in here I want to ask you about. Can we start with the family?
Yeah.
Because you've gone into an enormous amount of detail. I mean, a lot of people, you grew up in your family, so you just assume you know them. And you found out things about your German ancestry. And the kinds of things that your mom got up to, that I wonder if most people know about their parents. I mean, there must have been research that went into this too, because it's sort of nebulous for most people. You have facts and photographs and tremendous amount of work.
But also a tremendous amount of stories that I can't talk about, because I don't know how they end. I mean, there was a huge denial in my childhood. I mean, things we didn't know. For example, we didn't know my mother was Jewish until after she died. I mean, how do you explain that? My father knew, of course, and the family knew, but nobody told us as kids. And we didn't ask questions.
Which means you're Jewish, by the way.
I am indeed. I'm a Jewish Afrikaner. I belong to both chosen people.
Favut's dream.
Oh, please. Let's not start with him. But, of course, there's a very interesting thing. Talk about Favut.
Yeah.
I had a picture of him on the wall of my room when I was a little boy, because he was the hero.
He's the president as well, you know.
No, just Prime Minister, and a gift from God and all those things. And then I found a picture of Sophia Loren in a stage and cinema magazine. I was 11. And I stuck Sophia up on the wall next to Hendrik Verwoerd, and the next day Hendrik Verwoerd fell off the wall. She saved my life.
Well, you met her as well, and you've got a lovely picture of you and her.
Oh, yes, yes.
And a letter she wrote to you.
She's my friend. That's the first letter I got from her. After I'd found her apartment in Rome, and I left a letter for her there. And then when I got back to Cape Town, 1966, there was this letter from Sophia for me.
How extraordinary.
And so we became pen friends, and now we pals.
When last did you speak to her?
2 weeks ago.
Good heavens.
Yeah. In fact, she's on her way to London. On Sunday, she's going to be in the Aldrich Theatre doing a Q&A with Jonathan Ross, the story of her with the film and all that. And it's great. So Sophia's also on stage doing a one-woman show. You know, she said, "How do you do it?" I said, "You just go there and enjoy yourself. That's all you have to do."
So tell me about this moment that you put her up on your wall, because it's symbolic. It's apocryphal in some way, because she also inspired the character of Evita later on in some small ways.
I think, well, yes, how interesting. I mean, I just ended up, by the time I was 12, my walls were filled with pictures of Sophia Loren. So at least 400 eyes were watching me every time I took my clothes off. You know, so maybe I was used to an audience after that.
But what
and
eyes?
The extraordinary thing is, when I met her for the first time in real life in 1975 in Paris in her apartment, she invited me to come in with a drink, and I was waiting for her in her lounge, and she walked in, and it was like the picture just floated off my wall. I was so familiar and at home with this amazing woman. She said, "Hello, Peter." And it's an extraordinary thing. People keep on saying, "But how is it possible that you can become a friend of a movie star?" I said, well, it's not that. It's just, it's summer, it made sense. And now we're talking, and she said, you know, you're my oldest friend. I said, really? She said, well, everybody else is dead.
What an extraordinary thing.
Oh, my God. But she's now just great.
Because, you see, we think of you so much as being ours, and we think of you in our context, and we think of you with regard to having been a voice in politics for such a long time, in satire, in theatre. And the things you've done there are things you've covered in your other books. But in this case, we really do get to see you, and we get to see you in a family context. We get to hear about how your dad called you a bloody communist.
Yeah, yeah. All those things which actually the danger of the words. I mean, for example, when I was a little boy at school, I mean, there was an English school, and they called me Roenek, and they called me a boor, and they called me Muffy. All at once. And I didn't know which any of them meant, but I thought, well, you know, at least they're noticing
me. I'll take some of those.
I learned because I was always bullied at school because I was the little one.
Yeah.
And at the high school, when they say, hey, he's coming on. I thought, oh, he'll come. And they were going to club me, you know, but then I would tell them a joke.
And
the moment they laughed, I ran and hid into the girls' toilet so they couldn't find me there. And maybe that's where I realized that you've got to fight fear with humor.
In some ways, it's sad, because obviously it's not a pleasant way to grow up.
But we all grow up like that, being bullied and being frightened of the big boys. And I just thought,
I think it was a hard time to be a young man who was the kind of guy you were, this exuberant, talented.
I don't think I was that.
Tell me what you think.
I don't think I was that. I was a very good little Afrikaans boy that was terrified to break the rules, and I was wanted to do things that people liked. Would they like what I do? Is it okay? And really, truly, I was always the last one in the queue. And I didn't take part in sport because I was scared. I didn't realize the scrum could be such fun. I only found out that later on in the dark. But it was, it was really, truly. And I had that sort of timid fear right into my 40s.
Really?
I mean, I hid behind characters.
I hid behind
all these things. I very seldom actually had my own opinion on stage till about 1990.
But that's why this is so revelatory to me, is that you've always appeared to me to be much, much braver, much, much bigger, much, much stronger. And here you are saying you were very timid.
Well, I created a character called Peter Derges. I really did.
So there's, but you also created other characters.
Oh yes, but I had to.
So was Peter the case between you and the other characters?
I think I have a schizophrenia, a multiphrenia. But I've got the Peter and I've got the Dirk, and really sometimes we argue. The Peter is the one that I really like more, because Peter is the guy who said, "Ach, no, let's have a nice time." Dirk is very much your gentle Blanche mentality of, you know, you do it and you don't take rubbish. And so I am my own worst enemy sometimes, which is probably an interesting way to get on with your life. You know, I sort of ask myself questions and then I actually answer myself sometimes. And psychiatrists say, "Can we sit down and talk?" Because I also diet for a woman who doesn't exist, which makes me even more crazy.
Peter and Dirk, people are going to be careful what they call their children.
I was stuck with that. These voortrekker layers, Peter and Peter is and Dirk is, and my hyphen I put in there when I was at the Space Theatre in got back from London 1973. Space Theatre in trouble all the time with censors and police and everything. In Ibura, and my pa. And I thought, my name is Peter Dirk Eis, and I'm just going to put the hyphen between that. They are forced to remind themselves that my mens is in die voortrekker monument, your bliksem, jylle is nie daar. There's no boota there. There was no vervoer there, maar daar is eis daar. And so it's also got a nice rhythm. You know, Peter Eis, Peter Eis, Peter Eis, but Peter Dirk Eis, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. So, I am very proud of where I come from. I am not blaming my forefathers for everything that went wrong, because some things had to go right, including, I'm told, we had a great-great-great-grandmother who plied her trade on the road between Paarl and Cape Town in 1791, and her name was Wilhelmina Opklim.
That tells you everything about the job.
Yeah.
Klim op, Wilhelmina.
Klim op, makla, betaal, gaan we.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, we are 50%, they say, are the product of our genes, and 50% the nurture, the way we're raised, the resources we have, the things we're exposed to, blah, blah, blah. Now, I'm interested in the relationship between you and your mother, and then between you and your father, and how that made you into the person that you are. And you do go into some detail in the book, but give people who need to buy the book some of the tantalizing clues as to what sort of things you've discovered in retrospect looking at those relations.
Well, my father and my mother, both musicians, very important, pianists. So music was the perfume of my childhood. Mozart was my best friend. I didn't know he was dead. His music was so alive. And my father, very strict, and we didn't get on, he and I, because he said, have you practiced the piano, which I hadn't done. Did you water the garden, which I hadn't done. Maybe he saw a lot of himself in me as a kid. But my mother was always there to say, it's okay, and smile and say, yeah, yeah, yeah. German, from Berlin, left Berlin in 1936, just in time to get away. With her Jewish legacy and heritage, brought her piano.
She probably wouldn't have made it.
No. Brought her piano with her. Mm-hmm. And the piano is now back in Berlin in the Jewish Museum, which was another extraordinary story.
That is.
And she was just such a good friend, and really, truly, the balance of what my father. My father would bring the hard noise. He would bring the consonants, and she would bring the vowels. She has had a great generosity. She bought us things. She was always giving things. And my father was seinach, nothing. Je kreeg je penny van mij. That's why it was such a wonderful moment that when I could afford it, when I started making money with my work, I could say to my pa, I'm going to put a new roof on your house. I'm going to buy you a new car. I'm going to do everything. I'm going to give you a check every month. Just one thing, don't attack me about my politics, because then I'm going to take my checkbook and go somewhere else and pass it. No pity, it's a deal.
I mean, what an adult way to eventually deal with something that starts in a childhood.
And we had a wonderful childhood, a very protected childhood, and we were white people in a white country. Make no mistake, that's one of the reasons that I'm still alive. If I had been a black satirist, I would have not survived within the first 10 minutes. I would have been stopped then.
So your political conscience was established quite early on.
No.
No. Well, I mean, it's certainly you weren't afraid to argue with your father early on.
Early on, no. When I was in Pinelands, we didn't talk politics. I'll argue.
Were aware. I mean, you talk about how you saw life.
I saw life for the first time politically when I was probably in the Navy for my 9 months military training, and realizing that not every boy was like me. I thought everybody grew up like me. I thought everybody also liked Mozart. And I believe there were some roughies in the fluet, roughies. And then, of course, going to University of Cape Town and suddenly being plunged into that whirlpool of politics. This was in the 60s. And people were banned, and people were arrested, and there were bombs, and there were sit-ins, and Robert Kennedy came to give a speech, and I listened for the first time at a political speech that was pure theater. And I just, how? But really, as a kid, politics just did. My father wouldn't allow it at the house. He said, "Os prati politiek nie, is a failding." His cousin was Dr. D.F. Milan, the first premier. So my father's involvement with the echelon and the aristocracy of Afrikaans racist culture was huge, and he loathed them.
Did he?
He hated them. He said he couldn't stand them, and therefore they were never part of our lives. The Afrikaners that were friends of ours were also, I suppose, dissidents in their own way, and gay. There were a lot of gay people in my childhood, like Uncle Andre, who was a ballet dancer, and used to come on a Tuesday night because he was one of my father's best friends.
Yeah.
Andre. Always, okay. Hello, Hannes, darling. Okay, my pa.
But how fantastic.
Wonderful. And then Uncle Andre would sit next to me, always bring me Côte d'Or chocolate. Peter, here's up chocolate, darling. How are you, darling? I'm fine, Uncle Andre, I'm fine. And then one day, Robbie's leg used to bang against my leg. I mean, I didn't know this was supposed to not to happen. It just was a little bit embarrassing. And he winked at me, and he smelled a bit sweet.
Yeah.
And I remember one night he did this at dinner, and I got up, and we had a sort of an alcove with a big table and benches on either side. That was our little dining room. So I had to get up on the bench between the wall and the people. I went to the kitchen, and my mother was busy mixing the gravy for the food. And I said to her, I said, Ma, Uncle Andre's touching me on my leg. And she stopped. She said, What? I said, Uncle Andre, he does it every time, you know, Ma. He touches him on my leg and he winks at me, Ma. She said, darling, if you don't like it, sit somewhere else.
Oh, what an interesting answer.
What about that? She killed any prejudice that I would ever have against anybody by just saying, if you don't like it, sit somewhere else. If you don't like it, switch off. If you don't like it, turn the page.
You know, a lot of people would criticize that now. I think they'd be wrong.
Well, a lot of people need to be very careful about the way they create hashtags to try and hide their own prejudice. You know, it's a very personal thing. Everybody has the right to work it out for themselves, but don't be frightened to ask questions, because that's the thing I never did as a kid.
We
didn't ask questions.
Isn't it interesting, though, that and this is my observation in my limited capacity to have observed these things over the last few years, but it seems to me that wherever prejudice is at its very worst, there is some latent desire for the thing against which the prejudice arises.
Yeah.
It seems when there's anti-Semitism, there's something that's shameful in the person who's being anti-Semitic that they haven't confronted. If it's homophobia, it tends to be because deep down inside there are desires which have not been met.
Yes.
You know, Shakespeare addresses this in King Lear.
Yes. Yes.
It's a funny thing about humans that they tend to get very upset about things that they wouldn't get upset about unless those things meant more to them than they're admitting.
Well, I found this very much when I was specifically accepting my own homosexuality, my gayness, whatever you called it.
When did that start happening?
When did that start? I suppose I saw it for the first time in the Navy. Hello.
In
the Navy. I thought, what are they doing? And what? Hello?
By the way, Sia, who considers himself a proud member of the gay community and someone who's well-read in music, if you can have such a term. He didn't know that song until 3 days ago.
Take my gay card away. It's horrible. How did I not know the Village People? The Village People.
You'd never.
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness.
So you were in the Navy.
In the Navy. And so I saw sort of things there. But university actually maybe probably was the one place that I found out that I wasn't alone. Well, I thought I was the only person that was looking at the wrong side. You know, when I walked behind a man and a woman, you didn't look at the woman, you looked at the guy. And thought, why am I doing that? Because I don't like his shoes. But it was illegal. It was so illegal. It was when I went to university, it was illegal to be homosexual, to be gay. And there, one or two friends of mine were also, and we were careful not to be overtly noisy. And then on the other side, we used to go to parties, and then I broke another law because then I went and had relationships with boys who weren't white. And that was another thing that I wasn't allowed to do.
Immoral.
So slowly I broke down those steel barriers of what was right and what was wrong. You know, they said, if you break the immorality act, you will die. And I broke it, and I didn't die. I went back for more. So I kept on thinking, well, who's telling the truth here?
Sorry to interrupt you, but this is something that's just occurred to me now. Do you ever think about if you weren't a gay man and you weren't having relations with people across the color line at the ages that you did?
Yes.
Do you think you would have been, even with all your talent and all your ability, do you think you would have been as good at your craft had you not had to countenance these things as a result of your own predilections and persuasions?
I have absolutely no idea how to answer you because I wouldn't be here.
She would have been your uncle. I mean,
that is again one of the signposts that changes your life. And another one, and another one, another one. I remember in 1985, I was in Bloemfontein.
Well, thank you for that honest answer, by the way. It was a stupid question.
No, it's not a stupid question. It is an incredibly important question, but it's a very, very difficult answer to find because it is so loaded, and you immediately have to go onto all sorts of roadmaps and see suddenly not gay, therefore married, therefore divorced, therefore remarried, therefore divorced, therefore seven children, therefore a child who's gay.
You paint a horrible
therefore, don't
picture
understand
for straight
that,
people.
Therefore, you know, it's really a wonderful story. It's Dynasty. It's a whole TV series.
You could have written that story too.
But in 1985, I was in Bloemfontein with the premiere of Evita's movie, Skating on Thin Ice.
I remember it well.
And it was going to have Wuppertung's aunt and Alison Sue and Tani Vita was going to be there. And I was in the hotel and a journalist, Afrikaans journalist, was going to do an interview. And I know him by reputation to be a really rechter troublemaker, not somebody who's my fan. And he came in and he closed. I said, hello, Peter, man. Yeah, listen. Hello. What's done with it? I said, well, it says in the book starts. And he does. Yeah. And then he said, I said, listen, this is off the record. I thought, oh, now what's this? What's happening here? He said, you gay, eh? Here's a morphine, eh? Yeah, you are. You're homosexual. 1985, and I just thought for a moment, well, I just thought, oh my God, now here it comes. I've been dreading this. I knew it was going to happen at some time. What do I say here? If I say yes, everything I do is pushed into that corner and just covered with a rag. Ja, mais, en van hulle. And I don't know where it came from, but out my mouth, I said to him, you know, you weet, ja, I am. I'm a homosexual on Mondays and Wednesdays. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm a heterosexual. On Fridays, I'm bisexual. On Saturdays, I do it myself, and on Sundays, I rest. And, you know, he laughed and laughed and didn't want an answer to his question, and we got on with the interview. And maybe that was one of the signposts that taught me, again, humor is your weapon of mass distraction. You know, just don't fall into the trap of fear and anger, because you don't get anywhere there.
That is a genius answer.
So to this day, I think it was a very nice balance of possibilities.
Of course, also, if you'd said no, and you'd lied to him to protect yourself or to protect your business, you might have made enemies of people who were your friends.
But even the word no in that context was yes. You know what I mean?
Precisely.
It was Yania. Yania, of course, in Afrikaans. Yania.
The only language where you can get that.
Yeah, Yania.
All right, so that was obviously a very instructive part of kind of how you came to be this person that we know now. But they're also, your sister.
Yes.
That this is stuff I didn't know. This relationship that you two, she was a performer too. You know?
Fabulous, and fabulous musician, great pianist. And the one thing that I really, the legacy that I got from my musical family was the terror that they had before performance. They were catatonic with fear. I could smell the fear. It was like burning rubber. And I mean, I would go into the green room at the City Hall before there were three on the stage doing a Mozart triple concerto, and I didn't even know who they were. They were just standing there like, I thought, why? Mozart lives with us. He lives with us. Why are you so scared?
Yeah.
And I think maybe then I decided in my soul that I would never one day die of fear before I lived on stage. So I'm not in a state of panic when I perform. I mean, people say, are you nervous? And I say, no, actually, I'm excited. Excited means I can do it. Nervous means I can't do it. The feeling is the same. You still have a blur in your tummy. You know, you think, ooh, it's... But that terror, that absolute fear. And then Tezzy would, like, walk onto the stage, and you could just see totally in control. I mean, she left all that fear behind. And she's there, and she does it, and it's like magic. What they have to go through to get there, and many, many artists have gone and do go through the same absolute self-denial. And maybe that's just, I'm so lucky, because really, truly, I want to love what I do, otherwise I don't want to do it. And I want people to love what I do because I love what I do.
Have you ever not loved it, though?
No. I have...
Ever been doing a thing and you thought, ugh, this is not for me.
Yes, when I worked at the Department of Colored Affairs, when I finished school, my father got me a job.
Department
van Kleurlang Saker.
How hilarious.
And
that
I was a clerk. I was a filing clerk. I had to file all the colored files and the white files and the black files. And there was a typist there, a wonderful typist. Her name was Juffrou. I never knew her name. Juffrou van Aarde. So when I read the Van Aardes van Groot, when I got the same name, and she was very sexy and terribly rude, and she smoked and said gefloek, and she made me laugh, and she saved my life, because really, truly, we used to sit in the filing room in the cabinet and talk rude jokes and maak grappe and prop Elvis and all. But I hated it. I mean, I hated that job. And since 1975, I've been unemployed. So, I mean, I've never had a boss, and I've never actually had a meeting. I don't do meetings. I don't sit there like for hours on strategic disaster. I'd say, what's right? What's wrong? If it's right, make it better. If it's wrong, just send me an email of no more than 5 lines, because I haven't got time for this, because things can be solved very easily. You must just say, okay, that's wrong. What's the right thing to do? Now let's do it. So I'm very happy about that.
I'm looking through these pictures again, because you mentioned the pictures. They're a real feature of the book. And for me, the nicest thing about it is that you've published pictures of yourself when you were a little boy, yourself on stage. There's a picture here of you walking down Adderley Street where you look like Andy Warhol. Even in the shorts.
Which in the shorts,
the shorts,
yes.
These were very fashion forward. See, have a look at that.
There we are.
For 1966, ooh, somewhere
that's
on
right.
there, right?
That's a university, and already I knew what I looked like and what I could do on a Friday night with a beer in my hand.
I mean, look at there the hair. Look at yeah. the hair and your the denim jacket draped over your shoulder. I mean, you could be
and the
walking.
Mirrored sunglasses that Audrey Hepburn wore in the film.
Unbelievable. It's yeah. quite something.
There's a great picture there of my parents laughing.
Yes, that's a beautiful
picture.
Isn't
that a marvelous picture? There it is.
It's the most magnificent.
In their shorts. And we're in a summer holiday in Hermanus. And just that picture, I love that picture. I don't know what they're laughing. They must have been laughing at something wonderful. But I mean, just really private laughter. Beautiful. I love it.
You look a bit like them.
I do. I do. I've got my mom's nose and I've got my mother's legs.
Yeah.
And my sister's very cross because she's got my father's legs. So. Shame Tessie mustn't be cross that I said that. But I've got mom's legs. She had beautiful legs.
But I do get this overwhelming feeling that you had confidence from somewhere. Is it family?
I had protection. I was protected in a cocoon which I actually had to break out of to try and get a balance of the real and the... And I suppose not. It wasn't a fantasy, but it just was. And I found my inspirations through obvious music. But then I used to bring in soundtracks. I loved musical soundtracks, which my father would say, "Dai haras," which I mean, make that noise.
What kind of music? What soundtrack?
El Cid. That wonderful
Miguel
Roja, and Fall of the Roman Empire, and Gone with the Wind, and all those. And then I would listen to Springbok Radio and LM Hit Parade.
Yeah.
I didn't ever take to Elvis. I preferred Cliff Richard. And I believe it's his birthday today.
Is it?
It's Cliff Richard's birthday.
It's a funny...
It's a birthday.
All right. So tell me quickly about the piano, because you hinted at that story.
The piano came from Berlin.
You can't do that to people. You can't tease them like
no,
this.
They came from... The piano came with my mother on a boat from Berlin.
Blumer or something. Right?
Blüchner.
There we are.
And then...
The hero of the Franco-Prussian War.
Yes.
Blücher. He was actually one of the guys who
generals.
Defeated Napoleon.
Yes, that's right. Oh. Yeah.
Right.
And then the first professional job Ma got in Cape Town was to play on the stage of the City Hall with the Cape Town Orchestra a double Mozart concerto with a South African pianist called Hannes Ace. So she met my father on the stage playing Mozart.
Extraordinary.
So I keep on saying I must thank two people for being here, Amadeus and Adolf.
Yeah.
So the piano was there in the music room, and Tessie, of course, played the piano, and everything was around. The piano was like the Holy Grail. And I used to stand at the piano with my glass of red wine and write my plays. So on the piano was still that red circles of the red wine from the Tassenberg. And then when my mother died and the piano was sort of silent for a long time, my father didn't play. He stepped away from music because she committed suicide. I mean, the whole thing was just too awful for words. Then Tessie, of course, would come from London and play the piano. And then when my pa died and the house, it was Tessie's house because I wanted to get the hell out of that house because I got hay fever from the thatch roof. But no, I just wanted to move on. She loved the house and the piano. Anyway, she was in Berlin and she went to the Jewish Museum and she met the curator who said, "Oh, I believe that you're a pianist." And she said, "Yes." And he said, "You're Jewish. Your mother was Jewish. Your mother was from Charlottenburg." And she said, "Tessie, dear." And he said, "Let me show you something. We've got an exhibition upstairs I want to show you. It's called Heimat und Exil, Home and Exile." And it was an apartment of a Jewish family in Charlottenburg in the 1930s. That's what it looked like. The first thing that Tessie said, she walked in and her heart nearly stopped because most of the furniture we had in Pinelands, which our grandparents brought from Berlin in 1935 because they were there before my mother. Wow. They went to Cape Town. My mother's fiancé sent them to Cape Town in 1935.
Something prescient about
something
that.
They sat around a table and said, "Where can we go to
They must
hide?
Have picked up on those things because, you know, some people don't get the message. Huh?
No, extraordinary. And so Tessie said, "You know, there's no piano here. Every Jewish family had a piano, surely." And he said, "We can't find one." She said, "You know what? I've got one. I've got a Blüchner grand piano from Charlottenburg.
It was played
in Pinelands.
It was played by two concert pianists.
And it's went all the way back.
All the way
and
back
it's in the Jewish Museum.
Back home.
And it's there against the wall.
Still got your wine stay? Wine
the wine, because we said, don't Botox. This is an old lady. The keys must be yellow, the ivory. Don't make it all white and plastic. And that's my little wine thing. And And Tessie does recitals on her mother's piano once a year in Berlin. And when I do my shows there, my props are in the piano. So P.V. Boerter comes out of the piano.
Unbelievable.
And thing. So, so it's extraordinary. And I keep on getting SMSs from people who said, I'm standing next to your mother's piano in the Jewish Museum. And we are crying with joy because everything here reminds us of death. And this piano reminds us of life and the healing power of music. And that's great.
When I think about how attitudes to theater, to parody, to satire, to all the things that you do so well in South Africa sometimes need... We had an artist in here the other day, a guy called Yul Damaso. He painted that Autopsy of Nelson Mandela in the style of Rembrandt. Remember?
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes, yes.
And he sold it for 450,000 rand, and people were saying, you know, some people, I'm not going to label everybody, but some people were saying it's an outrage, this is a racist painting. That was what it was called by some people. Do we in South Africa still, because you dealt with this when it was probably a lot worse, and it was government-backed... anti-art movements, the idea that art wasn't just an expression, that it should be not just tolerated, but we should be enthusiastic about it.
Mm.
When you are confronted with attitudes like that now, does it make you feel like you're back there?
Funny you should say that. Yes, it does. I've been there before. I've been in the trenches. I turned it into a timeshare. You know, and now they come with me the same story. But last year, it was interesting. Some students came to see my show, and they walked out shouting at me. Said, you're a racist. Happily, they stayed in the bar because I told them earlier on that, you know, the drinks are on me when we meet after the show to chat. And when I went to talk to them, I said, you know, I gave you free tickets to come. You don't walk out and shout at me. You owe me money. You must pay for those tickets, and I'm going to send you a bill. They said, no, you can't do Zuma. You can't. I said, what do you mean? I do him so badly. They said, no, you're white. I said, what? They said, you're white. He's black. You can't do black. I said, I don't do black. I'm doing the president of South Africa, who needs to have the scalpel of humor to expose his corruption. No, they said, it's politically incorrect. It's racist. We'll have a hashtag, Ace Must Fall. I mean, but I've been through that. And that said, you're not allowed to do this, not allowed to do that. But, you know, it's a very interesting thing because, sadly, I think a lot of the young generation with their huge hashtag onslaughts have had an irony bypass.
Mm.
They just don't get it. And I say to them, just relax here. Have another drink and just calm down. And next time you really have a problem with what I do, don't shout at me and wreck other people's performance. Wait for me and we'll don each other backstage. That's okay. I don't mind that at all. But it set me thinking. And I thought, well, you've got to rethink many things as things develop. If people find it offensive, I don't mind offending people, I think it's very good. But if they feel that it demeans their culture and all the things that are precious to them, how can I then do Jacob Zuma in my show? So now I do P.W. Boerter first, mm-hmm. because I have to, yeah. My bread and Boerter.
And then, bread and Boerter.
And then instead of me doing Jacob Zuma as a white person, I have P.W. Boerter doing his impersonation of Jacob Zuma.
Ah,
so much now more interesting.
So there's Peter and there's Dirk.
More interesting.
Then there's Peter Dirk Ace. Then there's Evita. And then there's Piavia. And then there's... This is a lot of people to get this golden thread running.
I tell you. And it's really... And then also Piet Koornhof. Do you remember Piet Koornhof?
Yes.
Who used to be... Yeah, Piet Koornhof with the ears. And he used to move black people to the townships. Yeah, we put them into houses, into buses. And hey. I mean, a horrible...
And then ended up in a very publicized love affair with a colored woman.
Absolutely.
And it was an outrage at the time.
And he proved to the world that apartheid can't work.
And proved to the world when he appeared in your movie that he also had a sense of humor.
And he was a fan, which was very worrying, you know. But I do him in this new show. I do him in the show as a sort of... I say, this is what happened in 1985.
Yes.
And I say to the young ones, I say, Google and understand when you hear this that this was based on his own speech. So it's okay.
It's evolved.
Then I take Piet Koornhof and I put him into 2018 at Heathrow Airport, working for British Immigration. Thank you very much. Who's next? Okay, you Muslim. Can you take that mask off? You can't wear a mask here. I've got to see your face here. Is this your photograph? Okay, you want what? You want political asylum? We don't keep political asylum here. This is what Brexit is all about. I understand you. Okay. And then it ends with this guy saying to the other guys who are also there, he's saying, "No, mate, you people, I've said to you before, man, we had this in South Africa. We solved it, man. This bloody Brexit, you're doing it all wrong. Get all the apartheid laws, Google them and print them out. Immorality Act, Mixed Marriages Act, Population Registration Act. Then you just take out black and white and you put in Muslim." That has so clapped the audience.
That's
people
unbelievable.
Just go, "What?
Mm-hmm.
What are you saying?" I said, "No, what are you thinking?"
Yeah.
So that
they suddenly forced to confront their own prejudice.
So actually, to answer your question originally about, you know, what is it like now, it is terribly exciting because it's very, very difficult. I am not keen on easy. Easy is a pop pill, if you get my meaning. You know what I mean? I want something that's really difficult and possibly impossible. To find ways to, and to actually challenge you in the audience with something that you never even thought you'd see. And really laughing at things that aren't funny, but because it's actually fearful. And laugh at fear and make it less fearful.
Who counted up that you've done over 7,000 performances? I saw that somewhere.
I don't know, somebody did. That was about 4 years ago, so it's more than 7,000. But 7,000 is pretty, quite a lot.
That's a lot.
And each one is the first one and the last one. Each performance, first one, last one. Are no laurels.
No.
You know, you can't even wear them because you've got to hang them up because they're costumes for another show.
Well, I can only imagine how many millions of people have over the years seen those performances and got to have a little bit of you. Thank you for sharing even more of yourself in this book. I still have to make my way through about a quarter of it.
Okay.
Because Sia only gave it to me 2 days ago.
Okay.
But I loved the parts that I had read, and I always love seeing you, and I can't say what a national treasure you are because other people have said it better.
Say it.
You are a national treasure.
Thank you. And Donald Trump called himself a nationalist, so are we in the same boat?
I hope not. You got to do a Donald Trump in your next show.
It's very easy.
Yeah,
it's very easy. Very easy.
Just stick your head up your ass. Peter Derkes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a pleasure to see you. CliffCentral.com